Welcome back. It's a Monday, the 22nd day of August, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Call, and we're going to start off today with a story that happened over the weekend, a personal tragedy for a close Russian advisor to the president, Vladimir Putin, Alexander Dugin, who witnessed his daughter being killed in a car bomb explosion outside of Moscow. Russian media are saying that Alexander Dugin was the target of an assassination attempt. He was supposed to be in the Toyota Land Cruiser with his daughter Daria on their way home from a festival when the car blew up. But he had changed vehicles at the last minute, evidently to talk to someone, so he got to witness the assassination instead. AP says the explosive was planted in the SUV. The Russian government has blamed Ukrainian terrorists for it, or at least sympathizers that want to escalate the war. Zelensky et al. Have, of course, denied it. A later story attributed to Russia's ESB security service says that it was a young woman serving in Ukraine's Azov regiment, the infamous Nazi battalion, that had slipped into Moscow to assassinate Dugin's daughter, a pro-war journalist, before escaping back to Estonia in a Mini Cooper. What your host actually thought was most interesting and arguably provocative was the neocon spin from the pro-war European media. Here's a headline from the UK Telegraph that says Russia has blamed Kiev for killing the daughter of what they call Putin's Rasputin, but the truth may be closer to home. Yes, now, listen to this, folks, and imagine if some right-wing journalist, as they would no doubt phrase it, had said something like this concerning any kind of an assassination against somebody that they loved. They'd call it a conspiracy theory, wouldn't they? I guess only the left is able to call something a false flag and have it stick, so far as other leftist media is concerned anyway. The car bomb attack in Moscow, says the Telegraph, was most likely to be a false flag attack to whip up public support and escalate the war on behalf of Russia against Ukraine. Yeah, investigators had barely started picking through the wreckage when Kremlin-linked officials began blaming Ukraine for the audacious car bomb attack that killed Daria Dugin. Now, is the leftist media entitled to speculate, even to be wrong? Of course. But it does kind of look hypocritical, at least in hindsight, doesn't it? Especially given all the time after time after time after time after time that what they called conspiracy theories, while so many of those that obviously knew better, called them false flags, have turned out to be, well, actual conspiracies. From there, I'm going to go to several stories that, at least so far, don't qualify in either category, but certainly may serve as harbingers for things to come, one way or another. Case in point, Tony Fauci, arguably the most evil man drawing breath on planet Earth, and probably for centuries too, announced on Monday that he will be stepping down from his positions as the director of the NIAID and the chief of their laboratory of immunoregulation. Oh yeah, and he's also stepping down, hold your applause, from his position as chief medical advisor to the Biden puppet, fake Fuhrer. In a statement, America's Dr. Mengele said, "I am moving from my current positions. I am not retiring." Well, he said, not in the classic sense, and he would devote himself to, as Zero Hedge put it, the undoubtedly profitable circuit of traveling, writing, and no doubt scooping up the great big whopping honoraria that go with it. One way to think of it, folks, in your host's opinion, might be an ex post facto bribe for executions that, in some cases, are still on the hoof. But wait, there's more. One of the reasons I decided to talk about this story, other than just the joy of finally seeing this scumbag gone, even if it's not really and completely yet, was the timing. At best, call it suspicious, at least eyebrow-raising, perhaps better put, self-serving, or even an escape plan. Because when is Tony Fauci going to leave? December. And what happened not long before that? Well, that is the interesting question, isn't it? Was it the biggest midterm election rout in modern history? Or was the far left saved by the rig and a whole lot of electronic floating point voting machine switcheroo math again? And is there a possibility that people might have awakened enough that they say, hey, come on, fool me once, fool me twice even, shame on you, fool me over and over and over and over again, and to the point where it's not even remotely believable anymore? I've had enough. And either way, Fauci, who clearly should have been fired, if not tried, convicted, and arguably even executed by now, is way, way past his sell-by date. If the landslide is so big that the House and Senate fall to Republicans, well, his time is probably up. If, on the other hand, the election rig comes off as planned, and the communists consolidate their tyranny, maybe Fauci should take a look at what happened to the likes of Hitler's brown shirts, or Max Robespierre, or any number of history's other greatest terrorist evildoers. No doubt about it. I guess it's time, and it makes sense that he would try to get while the getting is good. Who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if he's already made a deal with the rhinos. But anyway you slice it, it's another one of those stories that helps illuminate the path we're on. Here's one more out of the UK. Probably won't get much press otherwise. There's been a sharp rise, says Zero Hedge, in the number of abandoned pets in the United Kingdom as the cost of living has skyrocketed and hyperinflation seems to be right smack on the horizon. This according to the Hope Rescue Center in Southeast Wales, which says they've received 300 calls in just the last 90 days from people who can no longer afford to keep their pets. I'll spare you the heartbreaking stories, folks, like Rollo, a one-year-old terrier, one of the many there at the rescue center. You can guess what the situation is for him. According to the center, the abandoning of pets was caused by what they call the perfect storm of increased dog ownership during the pandemic, combined with surging rents and, of course, food prices that are literally soaring out of reach. Not just for humans, but even more so, perhaps, for dogs and cats. According to the BBC, UK households bought 3.2 million pets in the first year after the COVID-1984 lockdown. And across the country, rescue centers are struggling to cope with the surge. So at the center, yes, it's very dramatic. It is a perfect storm. We're having to turn dogs away, and that's the hardest bit. It's heartbreaking, unquote. Which leads your host to make a sad observation, folks, but really, it's a warning. We're seeing similar stories in the United States. Lots of people who bought dogs especially can't afford to keep them. And what do? Eventually they turn them loose. And then guess what? You see dog packs on the street. And if you don't think that can be a real hazard, it's because we've never seen it here before. But I can tell you a story personally about being in a second world country once out by myself in a reasonably rural area on a four-wheel vehicle with no doors. I'd stopped to look at something, heard a noise, turned and thought, what the heck is that? And realized it was a group of about 20 formerly pets, now wild dogs, coming after me, literally salivating at what they thought they were going to get. I was able to hop in, start the vehicle, and begin to move away, but not before several of the dogs actually tried to leap in through the open doors and grab at my legs. One of them got a pant leg and ripped it, but thankfully, I was able to outrun them, and they kept coming for a lot longer than I was comfortable with. No, I didn't have a firearm at the time because, yeah, that's not allowed in a lot of third world countries, and of course, in most third world cities in America. By the way, if I did have one, I'd have gotten a good lead on them before I tried to use it, because as many of them as there were, I literally couldn't have fought them off with a gun at that point if I'd tried. And I mentioned that and this story because, like I said, these are harbingers. These are things that most Americans haven't thought through. And as a result, when things get to this point, they're probably going to be woefully unprepared, psychologically as well as physically. From there, let's move on to follow the money for today, because that's still important to do, even when the money really isn't. Money, that is. First, another one of those signs of the time. Second round effects, says another piece from Zero Hedge, from Europe's astronomical price increases are now coming in hot and heavy. What with both French and German 1 year ahead baseload electricity prices hitting levels, which mean that only a handful of the richest Europeans will even be able to afford power in a year, and the rest may soon be short a kidney. They're already being forced to take cold showers in some places. Europe's energy crisis has now claimed yet another victim, and this one, folks, will have ripple effects in the power-hungry metals industry. After Norsk Hydro said they plan to shutter an aluminum smelter in Slovakia at the end of next month. Because, as you may know, aluminum is one of the most energy-intensive metals to produce. And the closure of the Slovalco facility adds to growing signs of stress, to put it mildly, in Europe's industrial economy as power prices surge to new record highs after new record highs. It's why Hydro and others are now moving to shut down so many plants entirely. The region had already lost about half of its zinc and aluminum smelting capacity during the past year, mainly as producers decided to dial back their output. And this news came just one day after zinc prices jumped because one of Europe's largest zinc smelters had said they too would halt production next month as the continent's energy crisis literally threatens to hobble heavy industries. And just take a guess, folks, what that will do to prices going forward. From there, on we go to an upcoming event that's being watched with bated breath by those that don't have anything better to do, the Jackson Hole meeting, when the movers and shakers from the world's Mount Olympus will determine what interest rates and just about everything else economic will look like going forward. Here are some sample headlines. Dow, S&P 500, and NASDAQ are all down ahead of the Jackson Hole conference later this week, said USA Today. The Federal Reserve's Jackson Hole meeting could shake up the markets in the week ahead, warned CNBC. Personally, though, your host is a bigger fan of Egon von Graerts, who says investors had better buckle up. There's more pain ahead, and it's setting the stage for a Fed pivot that he suggests will rock global markets. The end is near. Trust in the U.S. dollar has slowly ended as the world turns quietly to gold. Matthew Pippenberg, partner at Matterhorn Asset Management, said it would be the understatement of the year to claim we live in interesting times, because we certainly do. But despite the inevitable attacks of appearing sensational, un-American, or just plain cynical, says Pippenberg, I feel a more appropriate phrase boils down to this. We live in dishonest times. And he and Egon von Graerts go on to address the Fed pivot debate, the inflation debate, and the U.S. dollar slow global decline in the setting of a now multi-foreign exchange new normal in which gold's historic bull market has yet to even begin. These are not views based on politics, they add, but on economics, which for some strange reason still ought to matter. The story begins with a look at the new normal, which they call open dishonesty. Says Pippenberg, I recently authored a site of a string of empirically open lies which now pass for reality on everything from the CPI inflation scale to the Cleveland Fed's real interest rate myth, or from official unemployment data to the new, now comically revised definition of what does, or more importantly, doesn't, constitute a recession. But the biggest whopper of all, at least recently, comes from the imposter masquerading as president in the Oval Office, Joe Biden, who earlier this month waddled to his podium and then promptly read to the world that the U.S. just saw, uh-oh, I hope you're sitting down, folks, zero, that's no inflation for the month of July. And it's sad, they note, when what now passes for national leadership lacks the most basic math or even ethical skills. But then again, they say, in all fairness to a Biden Fuhrer in open and just plain sad cognitive decline, this scumbag is by no means the first president, red or blue, to just plain fib for a living. You remember the rapist president, don't you? Honest Bill Clinton?
That all depends on what the meaning of the word is.
Who promised that allowing China into the World Trade Organization would be good for the working class, despite millions of them then seeing their jobs offshore to Asia only seconds later? Oh, and let's not forget the war on Iraq and those non-existent WMDs, the invisible weapons of mass deflation. Destruction, another Freudian slip there. Nor should we ignore that both Bush and Obama, as well as Geithner, Bernanke, and Paulson's assurances that a multi-billion dollar bailout, or the quasi-nationalization of the too-big-to-fail and too-big-to-jail banks, not to mention years and years of printing inflationary money like there was no tomorrow, out of thin air, was a, quote, sacrifice of free market principles that was needed to, get this, save the free market economy. Good grief. So, while it seems that the Biden Fuhrer doesn't really understand that less inflation than the ridiculously high level from the month before hardly means no inflation, as any Americans who have to pay bills already know. But what the July CPI not quite as ridiculously high level, aka an arguably temporary pause in inflation, does achieve is at least another headline myth to justify the inevitable Fed pivot to more easy money by year end, just ahead of the midterm elections, coincidentally. Or at the latest, early 2023. As we see, and he provides lots and lots of charts and information to make the case, the fiction writers, data gatherers, and fork-tongued policymakers in the District of Criminal Swamp have already been gathering more and more official data, and he puts that in quotes, rightfully so, to justify that Fed pivot towards a more dovish money printing and, hence, more currency debasement ahead. You could read it as hyperinflation on deck, folks. Specifically, the narrative is being pushed hard in the following data points. Decelerating inflation expectations, that's what a good sales job will do, I guess, declining online pricing, declining producer prices, and declining oil prices, well, at least from their ridiculously recent highs. Has inflation actually peaked? Are these so-called declines proof that inflation creates deflation by crushing consumer strength and hence price demand? Is the Fed's work nearly done when it comes to defeating inflation? Well, he says my short answer is no, and the longer answer is that when it comes to markets, currency, and economic conditions, there's more pain ahead. And as he says, we've both noted many times, the credit markets and the bond markets are the most important market and economic indicator of all. Earlier this month, the Fed's quarterly loan officer survey came out with some very scary and telling news, namely, that credit markets are tightening. And here follows one of those charts. But it's important to know, notes Pippenberg, that in the past 30 years, a tightening of credit has always preceded a recession, whether the big guy with the teleprompter lies about it or not. The hawks may, of course, argue that during the inflationary 1970s, tightening bank credit, a la Volcker, didn't stop the Fed from their hawkish rate hike policy. But let me remind you again, 2022 USA with a 125% ratio of debt to GDP isn't even remotely the Volcker era, where that same ratio only stood at 30%. Why? Because the Fed's primary, and as it turns out, only job is to keep Uncle Sam's IOUs, of which, of course, there are trillions, from drowning. The only way to keep U.S. Treasury from tanking, says Pippenberg, and hence bond yields and interest rates from spiking, is for the Fed to print more money, more money, more money to buy Uncle Sam's otherwise unloved debt. And that can be done only with more, not less, QE on down the road. Also, he adds, investors may have noticed that money is fleeing China in droves. Capital outflows are reaching levels not seen since 2015, which then sent the yuan to the basement by 2016. And I guess if it gets too bad, there's always a war. But does this mean that the foreign exchange jockeys, he said, should start shorting the heck out of the Chinese yuan? I think not. China seems to be holding her own despite the massive capital outflows. But how? Answer, China is openly mocking the U.S. dollar and backfiring the Putin sanctions. The financially inept and politically arrogant Western sanctions against what they still call Putin's war amounted to the biggest game changer in the global currency system since Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. And more to the point, despite the massive capital outflows, the yuan is remaining strong because its foreign exchange reserves, i.e. national savings account denominated in foreign assets, are actually rising and not falling. Where is the money coming from? Answer, just about everywhere except for the dollar-led West. Bottom line, the U.S. dollar is no longer either the toughest guy in the room nor the prettiest girl at the dance. There are lots of competitors, and they're getting stronger by the day. So what has this got to do with gold, he concludes? Well, basically everything. Because the U.S. dollar is slowly losing its shine, while gold, even though the paper markets are being manipulated, is gaining. Do you see how the U.S.-led sanctions, he said, were the biggest political and financial policy gaffe since Kamala Harris tried and essentially failed to be able to locate Ukraine on a map? Do you see why the BIS COMEX OTC price fixing earlier this year was the perfect and, of course, artificial and legalized fraud, and the timing was needed in order to keep gold cheap so that other nations could buy it? Perhaps all of this interest in gold rather than the U.S. dollar, they conclude, explains Saudi Arabia's recent push to refine gold within its own borders. And maybe it even explains the machinations of the two biggest paper gold price manipulators in the futures pits, J.P. Morgan and Citi, along with BIS unwinding most of their gold swaps. So maybe it's time now to connect a few dots, some of them going back almost exactly a year. We'll start with just a couple of comments from two different sources. One is from the Organic Prepper blog and a piece by Fabian Omar describing what he refers to as third worldization and the slow-burning SHTF, and I suspect you know what that stands for, of America, which still needed a K in it, even in April of last year. The question really isn't just how all of this third worldization is going to play out, because we can see it at this point. But it boils down to this, and he only hit some of the high points. The standard of living is dropping significantly everywhere. There's certainly an obvious increase in criminality, homelessness, an unchecked level of immigration or even invasion. There's a decline in private services and products as manufacturers and companies across the board have to cut costs to try to stay afloat and keep what limited profits they have. The situation in so-called public services, which don't make a profit, from infrastructure to sanitation, is obviously even worse. And all of this leads to something else that's already obvious. We're going to see increasing levels of inflation, even hyperinflation, along with deflation in certain areas, horrible levels of increased taxation, and outright confiscations, which is what government does when it can't tax or inflate enough to cover up for their crimes. On that score, Swiss analyst Egon von Gertz weighs in, noting that the paper silver price today is only half of what it reached during January 1980, in spite of the fact we've seen incredible and unreported inflation since then. Why? Because it has nothing to do with supply and demand. In a real market, he says, the price of silver would be substantially higher. But in a fake market, it's easy for the suppressors to simply sell virtually unlimited amounts of fake paper silver. In fact, every single physical ounce of investment silver is now estimated to be oversold with between 500 and 1,000 ounces of paper claims. especially when it comes to London and their LBMA, or the Crimex, Comex, things your host calls the crooked casinos. Von Gratz goes on to say that he's warned people against buying into silver ETFs or various funds of any kind because the risks are multiple. It's a paper security held within the financial system and thus has multiple counterparty risks. Furthermore, the gold and silver holdings are not segregated from the custodian's assets, which means they own no gold or silver directly. It's stored within the banking system. It's probably, and who knows how many times it's been sold or rehypothecated. It's certainly not fully insured. And investors basically will find, if they ever actually try to lay hands on it, that they don't have any actual access to their physical gold or silver. He goes on to talk about problems at the Perth Mint again, where numerous investors holding paper or synthetic silver at the Australian Mint are reporting delays of up to 4 months when they ask for delivery. But the real issue, as he and others have pointed out, is what he calls hyperstag-in-deflation. And if that sounds a bit chaotic, I guess it should. Yes, we should know that hyperinflation is a monetary event. It arises as a result of a major increase in money supply. Think printing and sending checks to everybody, including tons of illegal aliens, for example. Not to mention simply printing debt without limit. And it leads to total debasement of the currency. The Austrian School of Economics refers to the final event in this inevitable sequence as the crack-up boom, when the average Joe Blow on the street finally wakes up to the fact that the money in his wallet or his bank account is never, ever going to be worth again anytime in the future as much as it is right this second. So what does that mean? Yeah, spend it while you can. Hyperinflation, though, will occur mostly in commodities. Things like food, oil, hard assets, especially gold and silver. Oh, and let's not forget, lately, things like steel and lumber. But, says Von Gratz, hyperinflation isn't the only inflation we'll experience. We're also going to see stagflation and deflation. Bubble assets like stocks, bonds, and property can deflate, at least in real terms, being measured in a constant purchasing power of gold or silver. There'll also be stagflation, which means economic stagnation combined with this type of hyperinflation, as the cost of living, and things like food prices especially, will rise dramatically, while at the same time many people lose their jobs. Pensions and Social Security payments will not in any way be able to keep up with the inflation, and people will sadly end up being destitute. His solution is one that he's talked about many times, and we have here as well, things that have been real money for about 6,000 years, especially gold and silver. Von Gratz believes the paper gold correction ended before the end of March, just under $1,700 per fiat ounce. He thinks the risks in the stock market, on the other hand, are massive and a crash could happen at any time, and suggests that what's coming is the biggest bull market in the history of real gold and real silver. And as the first article I mentioned from Fabian Omar in the Organic Prepper blog notes, it's important to try to mitigate against the coming financial collapse and hyperinflation combined with deflation in certain assets. Which leads me finally to these observations from Brandon Smith, also a libertarian and kind of Austrian-oriented, at alt-market.us, who notes that globalists are fixing for it because they'll need another crisis in America as their reset agenda seems to be failing. When it comes to medical tyranny and the coming poke, we're actually seeing resistance in a number of European nations at this point against forced vaccinations and the vaccine passport, although it's unlikely they'll have the ability to repel a full march into totalitarianism. Meanwhile, most of the rest of the world, especially Asia, India, and Australia, are already well under control, which leaves formerly free America, especially flyover country, where he says conservative Americans in particular have long been a thorn in the side of the globalists. And it really comes down to a simple matter of mutual exclusion. You cannot have an openly globalist society and conservative ideals, like a Bill of Rights, at the same time in the same place. It's impossible. Because conservatives, he said, believe in limited government, true free markets, individual liberty, the value of life, freedom of speech, private property rights, the right to self-defense, the right to self-determination, freedom of religion, and the non-aggression principle. In other words, we won't harm you unless you first try to harm us. But none of these ideals can exist in a globalist world because globalism is, at its core, the pursuit of fully centralized tyranny. It's been a long time coming, folks, and a slow build, but I hope now you can see just how much has changed and accelerated in just a bit over a year. Thanks, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.